This is Orson Welles speaking. The place was Batesburg. Isaac Woodward thought it happened in Aiken. He was wrong. I've repeatedly explained Woodward's mistake and repeatedly apologized. But I broadcast his affidavit. Now the city of Aiken, having banned my movies, burned the posters in the streets, and hanged me in effigy, is threatening, believe it or not, to sue me for the sum of $2 million. Well, if I had all that money, honestly, I wouldn't mind owing it to Aiken for the pride of having finally put the blame where it belongs. The blame belongs, as I say, in Batesburg, South Carolina. It was Monday, February 13th, 1946. A minister and several workmen saw the police chief of Batesburg and a highway patrolman pouring buckets of water over the head and body of a soldier who had been arrested the night before. What the policemen were washing away was blood. And between each bucket, they stopped and asked the soldier, "Can you see yet?" Each time, the soldier answered, "No." The soldier was a Negro. We know now that his name is Isaac Woodward, and that the police chief had beaten him the day before and blinded him with a blackjack. When I stumbled on the story several months later and brought it to public attention on this program, the name of the guilty policeman was unknown, and it looked as though it always would be. I promised to get that name. I have it now. The minister and the workman provided our investigators with one clue, and there were other clues. All led to a single man. All clues led to Mr. M.L. Shull, chief of police in Batesburg, South Carolina. Now we have him. We won't let him go. I promised I'd hunt him down. I have. I gave my word I'd see him unmasked. I have unmasked him. I'm going to haunt Police Chief Shull for all the rest of his natural life. Mr. Shull is not going to forget me. And what's more important, I'm not going to let you forget Mr. Shull. Now, here's a letter. It goes like this. "Well, Mr. Wells, you've just lost yourself an ardent fan. That little speech you made on the radio about that Negro got his eyes poked out, did it? You don't know a thing about this case, and I'm quite sure I heard the correct side of the story, being as I live in the very state in which it happened, and proud of it. But it seems that the Yankees always have to pick on somebody about something, and especially the South. Well, I'm going to put you wise for once. If the North would let the South alone a while and not try to bully them, everything would soon turn out just right for everybody concerned. We want the Negro to have a fair chance. We don't believe that the two races should mix, however, but it seems that the North is trying its darndest to make a mulatto nation of the whole South. Well, it isn't going to work. I believe that we would all die fighting, men and women side by side, before we would let a calamity like this happen to the glorious homeland of gallant men and their women who have certain well-founded beliefs and never take anything from anybody." Now to get back to that story. I've been around associating with the policemen around about, and I happen to know that the Negro who received the eye injury was extremely insolent, very unruly, tried to make a getaway from a police officer. Seems you all want to give the Negro a better chance than you would a white man. And, my dear man, I shall present a startling fact to you. The policeman in question did not cause the eye injury to the Negro. It was due to a fight the Negro had with another Negro. And he is trying to put the blame on the officer so he will draw a pension. Think that over, Mr. Orson Welles. Doubtless you have lost quite a few fans from that little dramatic speech you made, so full of emotion and tragic tears for the man. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Signed, your former fan." Well, we've been getting a lot of those anonymous letters since we broke the Isaac Woodward case on this program. Let this answer them all. "Dear former fan, you say the North is bullying the South, and if the Yankees would stop always picking on somebody for something, everything would turn out just right for everybody concerned. I'm afraid you're missing the point. Batesburg isn't another battlefield of the Civil War. The sides contending over the scandal of Isaac Woodward aren't the blue and the gray. They are the right and the wrong. And on your side of the Mason-Dixon line, as on mine, most of the people are on the right side of that argument. Of course you're proud to live in South Carolina. You ought to be. But I think you'll find that most of your neighbors in South Carolina are ashamed of Mr. M.L. Shull, a police chief who beat out the Negro soldier's eyes with his blackjack. I'm proud to live in America, but I'm ashamed of Chief Shull and his blackjack. I'd be ashamed of him if I was a citizen of Tibet. Isaac Woodward was not involved in a conspiracy to make a mulatto nation of the South. He was just taking a bus trip to Winnsboro to meet a young woman who belongs to his race and who bears his name. But Isaac Woodward never got to see his wife. He'll never see her. Never. Isaac Woodward is blind. Why? Because the North is bullying the South? And my dear former fan, your startling fact about the eye injury, those are your words, eye injury, being the work of another Negro is meaningless in the face of Chief Shull's own confession. He did it himself. And even Chief Shull doesn't claim he was defending the sanctity of white womanhood. Even Chief Shull doesn't claim he was keeping Isaac Woodward from marrying his sister. Well, that's enough of that for now. We'll come back to Mr. Shull next week. And the week after that. The week after that. My time remaining is dedicated to a man whose name we'll never, never know. Before the year now generally called Munich, perhaps a season or so earlier, there was a treasure hunt in Paris. Please visualize the celebrants, not as Parisians, but as notables, as they mostly were of a very publicly gay wing of international society. You may know that a treasure hunt proposes a number of unlikely quests. And when the list is imaginative, it can be fun. Here was a treasure hunt for the history of the game. There was no limit to the mad invention of it. One item was something unmentionably intimate. That's all I know about it. A possession of the mistress of a cabinet minister. Another prize was a legal certificate of marriage binding between a couple who hadn't considered any such solemnity. There are a dozen more of these treasures, all as extraordinary. And for a climax, nothing less than a cigar, still smoking, lit at the flame which burns forever by the tomb of the unknown soldier. Now, decency expects of a tomb that it guard for the lifetime of stone what was once the habitation of the spirit of man. The conscience of the world defends the memorial of those who, in the last wars in this, died for peace. You agree we catch a glimpse here of something worse than mere bad taste, picnicking on an old grave, something perverse, wickeder than any casual defilement of God's image. Only another bad piece could make anyone laugh at a dead soldier again. Of course, whoever lit his cigar from that flame may have thought the unknown soldier wasn't anybody he knew. It's true there isn't anybody in particular to mourn for the man who was buried there, so everybody mourns for him. The marker can't have known that he profaned his brother's grave. But how could he forget? The sense of man's brotherhood is all that can sustain the human spirit for the loss of God. And this man had no God. By what did he live? The loss of faith is the condition of despair, and the alternative to despair is the worship of Caesar. What sure is that the mocking of sacrifice cannot survive elsewhere, but in that evil climate of the soul where fascism prepares its subjects. Very probably the man with the cigar was one of these prefabricated pagans who rode the joyless carousel of the 20s and 30s. One of those, you know, who doubted if anything is ever really bad or really good. If the man with the cigar is alive, he may have changed his mind. If possible, he found something bad enough to fight. He may even think that something good is real enough to defend. I think we know these things, but never say them enough. Bad and good have been at war, God knows, since the first morning of the world. Men do the fighting. If they didn't, this planet would be nothing better than a zoo. Faith is the tinder of man's greatness. So long as he shields it from despair, he's going to keep the gift of fire. There is one choice, no more. One choice and no exemptions. Those who believe this recent war can be the last are those who won it. Those who lost suppose that war itself breeds without cure in the nature of all people. These are the same who fattened on this war. They are the same who plan the next one. The slaves doubt their kind's capacity to learn and change. The slavers curb with doubt the people's righteous will to abide by its own laws. They are all the same. We have this to be glad of. These who are of little faith, the blasphemers, experts in chaos, or the sick in spirit, These who can't, who won't affirm the plain, magnificent decency of human folk, all such on this our brightening world are rallied in the shadows now under the banners of despair. Defeat is their profession and their destination. Victory rises even today before the men of faith. This last war might have been the last war. If it was, and only if it was, we'll know the world's first peace. But let's have an end to the old stalemates and manipulations. The people want a government of all their nations. The chance to know each other better, to visit neighbors and make friends. They want open borders. They want everything printed in the newspaper so that they know whether they like what's going on or whether they don't. They're tired, the people are, of secrets and spies. They're tired of striped pants. The people want their own diplomats, and all these things the people are going to have unless they're cheated out of them, Paris notwithstanding. If free men who fought for freedom aren't going to be allowed to destroy fascism, if anything that looks like fascism is suffered to sit down among us, the cynics will be right again. An ordered world where everybody's free to prosper and improve is still a far-off dream. The Fuhrer gave his sway 1,000 years. His doom is sure. He lost. But those who fought him know they may not win. That 1,000 years of his was a good guess. At least 1,000 years waits on the chance of another war. Another war means worse than the leveling of all the cities. We know that. It means retreat, a setback longer than the quarter of a century wasted since the unknown soldier died for us. 1,000 years is a long march. We are the ancestors of unknown soldiers who must go that bloody length again, unless we who are weary of marching go on marching. Forward is the way, forward, beyond peace. On into the free world which depends on it. A free world means just that. We must refuse all substitutes. A free world depends on that refusal. Liberals have a lot to say nowadays about the danger of reaction. Reaction is no danger. It's a certainty. Maybe it won't amount to much. Maybe it's going to be a tidal wave anyway. The answer isn't written in the stars. It's up to the democratic man. He must stand fast now. This time he daren't lose, or nothing will be left. Nothing even to start with. And they'll build a new war monument, not to the unknown soldier, but to the unknown cause. Maybe they'll keep an enigmatic little flame alight there to show where freedom died. But nobody will start a cigar on that sepulcher. Wouldn't even be funny. The alternative, of course, is civilization, a bookish and uneasy word, that civilization. Our languages will bear us fairer names for it when we've struggled closer to what we would describe. Peace then will go as unremarked as the free air. Peace, after all, is no more than the victory of the farm over the wilderness. As probable as that, no more hard-earned. But never think our work is over when we've won that peace. We'll know better. And even when the world is free, we'll know we've just begun. Here it is. Here is the peace, we'll say. Standing in the midst of it, like plowmen, content with the good order of their fields. Standing together, since mankind will be every man's family when the tools of war are put away for good. Here is peace. Here is peace, we'll say to each other, proudly, undismayed. Nobody will confuse it with a millennium. Then the abundance of the human spirit will be ready for harvest. And even the children will see that final peace is merely history's first important date. Now I see my time's up. Thank you for letting me come to call. Please make a date for next Sunday at this same time. Until then, I remain as always obediently yours.
This is ABC. The American Broadcasting Company.